Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. In Texas, around 1 million people were still without power Thursday morning after a powerful winter storm pounded most of the central and southern parts of the United States. Residents are seeking warmth in their cars, scrounging for gasoline, going without critical medical supplies, and running low on food. In the meantime, government officials in Texas are pointing fingers at who they think is to blame, but there remains little relief in sight. And Texas is not alone. The increase in intensity of these climate change-related weather events could spell more trouble for the American power grid, which remains woefully unprepared. So we begin today with a discussion about why, from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico to wildfires in California to winter storms in Texas, the failure of our power grids continues to put Americans at risk and what we can do to improve them. I have Ivan Penn, an energy correspondent for the New York Times, with us. Ivan, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Julie McNamara is also with us, and she's the senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Ivan, how old are many of our electrical grids across the country?
Well, we're talking about a system that is 100 years old. And of course, we saw, as you mentioned, the wildfires in California, the worst of them as far as fatalities, the Camp Fire, which was sparked by a 100-year-old tower that was, by the utility Pacific Gas and Electric Standards, 25 years past its useful life. So you see that a lot of the equipment is not only old, but it's outdated.
Julie, many of our grids are centralized. What does that mean? Does that mean that many of them are public utilities? Are many of them private? What does that tell us about the actual infrastructure?
Sure. So what that really is getting at is this idea that historically we had a grid built around these large power plants, these large coal plants, nuclear, these generators that were often far away from load. And then we'd have these large transmission lines, right? Those high power lines that you see, taking that electricity from these power plants all the way to cities. And then we get to the infrastructure, like substations, that then convey electricity into the wires you see running around town, such that the electricity comes from that all the way that long distance to get to your home for when the light switch is flipped. But that's changing. As we get more renewables online, we're moving from that centralized one where those large power plants provide so much of the power, where they're supposed to be on all the time, to more decentralized loads where we have electricity resources in many more places.
That sounds like it could be a good thing.
That's right. I think we see a lot of opportunity here, because what we know is a problem is if we have these major points of vulnerability, because if you have such large power plants or power lines, one point of failure can have a much bigger impact. Whereas if you have a more decentralized system, you're able to ride through better so that the an outage that you see may be limited in scope.
Ivan, let's talk about what's happening in Texas, because that's the most recent example that we have. There's a lot of finger pointing among politicians about who did what. What do we know about why the Texas power grid failed?
Well, and to be clear, the grid itself, which is the network of wires and substations, the grid itself did not fail. But what we did have was problems with freezing of pipelines and power plants going down. Part of this was a lack of reserves. Texas decided to isolate itself. It is unique in the country. Most of the country has a system where you have required reserves. Texas decided that it would use market forces to drive how the system operated. So basic supply and demand. When demand really goes up, the idea is that the price goes up and consumers then will use less power. So then that'll help bring the price down. And then also the high prices would cause generators, power producers to come into the market and bring more power. But there wasn't the access that was needed to fuel, to power plants, and then power plants were failing. You had more than a third of the generation capacity that was unavailable at one point. And that was a decision by the state of Texas in how it was going to operate its electricity system. It was an economic driven one rather than what you see in most of the country as a systematic requirements for reserves.
But Ivan, does that mean that Texas is an anomaly in this case, but does that mean that our infrastructure across the country is in good shape because it isn't part of an economically based decision? Or does that mean that we have power grids that are still at risk here because they aren't, to our earlier point, updated?
Well, so no, that's not the case. It's just the driver in the Texas situation. Again, if we look at California, we had rolling blackouts last summer that were driven by a variety of circumstances, including the fact that, a lot of times it's planning, a lot of times it's the age of equipment. So it's a variety of factors. And then economics does actually drive a lot of this. Part of that economic driver is the fact that, the utilities, many of them are investor owned and driven by Wall Street profits.
Julie, I want to bring in some more specifics here about Texas. And I want to get back to, Ivan, to your point on profit-driven motives here and whether that actually serves the public in terms of, we need electricity to live, we need it to survive, we need it to connect, especially in this moment, so how that influences us. But Julie, in terms of the finger pointing that was happening in Texas, there were Governor Greg Abbott, I believe, said, well, it was the frozen turbines, it was the green energy, alternatives that we had put here that actually hindered this ability to get Texans the electricity they need. Is that true?
It's simply not true. It is false. And the truth is, the power grid was beset by failures at every level of the system. We saw challenges with outages along the wires in the power plants. There was a serious mismatch between supply and demand. But the biggest outage that we saw, the biggest problem that we saw of all, was with the natural gas system, both with problems in supply and with problems at power plant generators. I think what we saw with this narrative, this leap to blame renewables, was grasping at an out from accountability. There's just no way this wasn't advanced in bad faith, because it was out there from the start. It's not grounded in fact, and there's no basis.
And I'm wondering, Julie, is renewable energy infrastructure less susceptible to disasters in general, or does it also have to be weatherized properly in order to manage more and more extreme climate?
All of our infrastructure has to be better prepared for climate impacts. For too long, we've continued to build our infrastructure based on the past. But the fact is, the past is no longer prologue. We have to build not just for the climate impacts we know are coming, but the climate impacts that are here today. Just this year, the Texas grid has faced flooding, extreme heat, hurricanes, now this cold. It's not enough to just think about how the grid has worked in the past, right? It has to be prepared for the future. And that's something that has to happen at every aspect of our infrastructure. So that means, yes, these power plants had to be better prepared for cold weather. They also have to be prepared for extreme heat. We see potential with this clean energy transition to move, as I was saying before, both to a a more decentralized system to limit the vulnerability of any one outage risk. We also see what we know is so clear here, a systematic underinvestment in our infrastructure. So as we transition to clean energy, we have a real opportunity to invest in grid modernization with infrastructure that is fully incorporating from the start the climate impacts we know we'll see.
Ivan, let's talk a little bit about that underinvestment in infrastructure. It's almost become a joke, tongue in cheek, for people to talk about the federal government talking about infrastructure week, right? We know the American infrastructure system, including our bridges, our tunnels, our roads, are all struggling. But how much have we underinvested in our power systems here in the United States?
Again, I'm gonna turn to California, because we saw over the course of years, from 2017 in particular, through last year, the wildfires that cost scores of lives, decimated communities, and a big driver of that was Pacific Gas and Electric, which went bankrupt over all of these wildfires. And as we saw in the bankruptcy, Pacific Gas and Electric did not maintain its equipment across the power system, its natural gas infrastructure. And what they did do with the money was to give bonuses and to money to shareholders. Their primary responsibilities are to provide safe and reliable service to their consumers. That PG&E is the largest utility within any individual state in the country, and it failed to do its basic service. It ultimately was convicted of 84 counts of involuntary manslaughter related to the deaths of people in the city of Paradise, which was destroyed. And again, because of a failure to maintain their equipment.
Julie, what types of communities are most at risk during these kinds of disasters? And does that factor into power grid planning? And I guess the real question there is, are low-income communities most affected? Are communities of color most affected by these types of disasters?
Yeah, so electricity underpins so much of our daily lives, from the mundane to the critical services that keep society running. What we see right now in Texas is, right, as outages persist, you get cascading disasters, once separate and apart from whatever triggered the event. Disasters all their own, as we see now, right, with the failure of water systems, at least in part owing to troubles with persistent and ongoing outages. So this is a problem that affects all of society. That said, there are some populations who are especially vulnerable to long duration outages like this. And those are those least able to cope when the power goes out. That runs a variety of groups. That includes senior citizens, low-income populations, communities of color, places where you can't readily evacuate or don't have money to be able to travel and stay in a hotel somewhere where there's power, where the cost of losing the food that's in your refrigerator is too heavy to bear. These are major considerations, and when we think about how important it is to keep the grid up, it's not just to keep everyday life going, because yes, that's critically important. We can't, an outage like this is simply untenable, but it also means we need to boost the resilience of these communities themselves. That means that even if a power outage does occur, these most vulnerable populations have the ability to keep the lights on. So, right, that's that top-down system-wide resilience. At the same time, you get that bottom-up resilience. One thing we don't talk about that much, but is critically important here, is the idea not just of keeping the wires and the power plants online, but also energy efficiency and weatherization, so that, right, when you're in your home, you can be able, both this is for hot weather and cold weather, be more comfortable, be able to last longer should an outage occur.
We have heard stories. We interviewed a reporter in Texas yesterday who said he was under multiple blankets, wearing multiple layers, and had done everything he could to stay warm. The images that are coming out of Texas of freezing items in homes and et cetera are just really, really unfortunate right now. Ivan, all of this is going to cost money. Upgrades to electrical systems aren't cheap, but neither are blackouts. So what does the decision-making look like? Maybe in Texas is a unique example, but what should government officials be thinking about when they're going to do this?
Well, one of the big issues is where you apply government subsidies. The renewable energy industry is looking for the government to put into place some tax credits for things like batteries. We subsidize, you know, virtually every area of the energy industry, but some of those tax credits aren't applied to all of the renewable sector, particularly right now, batteries. There are technologies being used in various parts of the country, like Utah, for example. When we start talking about the need to address those who are disadvantaged, there's an apartment complex that has solar panels, and every apartment unit has a battery in it. If the grid goes down, someone in their apartment can actually still have power because they have a battery in that apartment unit. So there are creative ideas to address the needs to protect individual citizens of all economic statuses. So there are ways to do this, but you do have to look at how we distribute even the tax subsidies, which is the purview of the government. And from there, you know, where do you put the resources of the utilities in the approval process for, Julie mentioned energy efficiency and weatherization. Do you charge more to build power plants, or do you take the investment and put it into weatherizing, especially disadvantaged homes, helping them to get solar panels and batteries? It's a question of how you distribute the resources, and not just how much might be available.
And we end up paying for it one way or another. Ivan, we've got a little bit over a minute to go, but I just am curious whether or not the Biden administration has any, they said they were going to send diesel fuel to Texas, but beyond that, are there issues, or do they have a plan to upgrade our electrical infrastructure in this country? We've got about a minute left.
Sure. Well, the president has, from the campaign trail until now, made very clear that addressing climate change, bringing more clean energy, these are priorities of his administration, and he has put people in place to push that forward. So the question is whether we'll see the proof in that pudding.
Ivan Penn is energy correspondent for The New York Times, and Julie McNamara is a senior energy analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So 1 year into the pandemic, how's your pod holding up?
It's kind of like Russian roulette. So far, so good, but you never know.
Early in the pandemic, many of us formed bubbles or pods, small groups of people we decided to stick with through COVID, to share risk, but also the benefits of continued human interaction and vital support. But as we enter into a second year of the pandemic, this time with the possibility of vaccinations, people are faced with new questions about what's safe for their pods and what rules to follow. And here's how your pods are faring.
This is Kazoo. I'm calling from the East Bay. My wife and I have been in a pandemic pod with a family that we're good friends with. We have had about two people in the pod have been vaccinated. I myself am recovering from coronavirus. And it's been a little tricky because anytime somebody either has a work-related thing where they have to break their pod or a family member comes to visit, we all go into these quarantines. It's working out. It's nice to have some people to connect with without having to be quite so scared.
My family has been in a pandemic pod with my parents and my in-laws since March. However, we are currently experiencing record weather here in Texas, and because most of our community is without electricity or water, we have had people in our home that we haven't been able to see in such a long time. It seemed like a trade-off that was worth it.
My name is Deborah, and I'm from Salem, Oregon. I have my sister, her husband, our 92-year-old mom, and my husband in our little bubble. It hasn't changed since March 26, 2020, which was the last time we saw our daughter and grandkids. I drove an hour each way to see them once or twice a week and volunteered at their private school. I am so sad some days. It's unbearable. But we have our family, and we try to make the most of it.
This is Emily from Clemson, South Carolina. I have shifted from a pandemic bubble to a pandemic funnel. I gather in only small groups of usually three people. My church had already moved to a three-person small group format before the pandemic shutdown. My triad has been a reliable, encouraging support and source of belly laughs as we gathered outside in warm months and now share warm meals at home in the cold season. So it's not that my bubble is closed, but that funnel means that I can contact easily anybody that I have sat in a room with. Thanks, Takeaway.
Our bubbles have shifted somewhat. The first few months, we utilized virtual meetings and shared cocktails and games this way. During the winter, several friends have done an extraordinary effort to convert outdoor spaces for us to gather. It's all been walked in tandem with checking in, speaking hard truths, and holding each other and ourselves accountable for our broader well-being. This is Holly Freeman in Portland, Oregon.
My name is Simon Spanton. I live in Gilbert, Arizona. My wife and I have kept the same routine. My wife drives a half hour one day a week to shop and clean home for her mom, and I buy groceries 2 days a week. And we have spent holidays and anniversaries with my mother-in-law and sister-in-law.
Hello, I walk 7 mornings a week. It really has actually given me a good sense of community when there isn't much community to be had right now.
This is Tom McCarter at Vista, California. We are operating in a pod bubble with family and assuming that everybody is secure and safe. But you never know who they have brushed up against in the course of a day, who might not have been wearing a mask. It's kind of like Russian roulette.
Now we're going to bring in an expert voice to hear how these pods have changed in the past 11 months since COVID-19 reached the United States, and how they may change in the coming weeks and months with the rollout of the vaccine. Carrie Althoff is an associate professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins University. Carrie, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So the idea of pods or bubbles came about in order to sort of prevent transmission. How effective was this as a concept? Let's start there.
So this concept is not new for this pandemic. This concept has been a concept we've studied and understood through infectious disease epidemiology for quite a while. And essentially what we're doing is we're just closing down our networks so that we reduce the risk of exposure to the virus. So, you know, we've loved to see people pod up. I think it's been really important, particularly for people who are alone, particularly for kids and families. So I think these pods have been really helpful in trying to keep people connected, but in very small ways so that we don't have large groups gathering.
Are there, you know, rules in terms of how many people is an ideal number, or should we be opening our pods?
The number is a function of a couple of different things. First of all, it's a function of the members who are in the pod, right, and what their exposures and risks are. And then it's also a function of how much community transmission is going on. So there is no one number for a pod, but really it has these influences that you have to consider. And I think some of that is why we've seen changes in pods over time, in addition just to the fact that after a while, if your family has been podded with one other family, maybe it's just time to see a different family for a while. Maybe your kids match well with two of their kids, but the third felt a little left out. Or if you're a single person, maybe your pod was a group of friends that you were connected with through work, and now perhaps you've changed jobs or something else has happened. So over time, we've seen these pods kind of change. But the idea with a pod is that there's an agreement. There's an agreement about who you will see outside of the pod and who you will not see outside of the pod.
And when you say see, Carrie, do you mean see outside, or are pods places where we can feel comfortable going inside to see people and see people? I've had people who have been very upset if I've asked them, well, you know, where are you without a mask indoors? And there's sort of a, how dare you ask me that question response. And I think that's a normal question in these times.
It is. And really, that's what it was about. Who you could be unmasked and indoors with and running between houses, for example. But you know what? That's what we mean by see when we're talking about in a pod. And that is an agreement that the members of the pod have to come to. I've seen pods who write out their agreements. And if there's something where somebody goes to visit, let's say a family member that's outside of the pod, then there are specifications and guidelines around the time that they have to wait when they return before they can re-enter the pod, so that if they are exposed, those infections can be seen and can be dealt with and taken care of, and people can recover without exposing other people. So at the core and at the strictest definition, a pod is an agreement among a small number of individuals who agree to only interact closely face-to-face or without masks in indoor settings. And so it gets to be, you know, really, really small numbers. And then for interactions outside of that, right, you can have discussions about, well, my kids and I go for walks in our neighborhood and we might encounter other friends outside, but we're wearing masks and we're keeping our space. And if your pod is comfortable with that and you're adhering to that, you're protecting the pod and the pod will protect you.
Carrie, I'm also wondering, pods really rely on trust. And I don't think a lot of people expected pods to have to last this long. It almost sounded like, oh, great, I'll hang out with these couple of people for a couple of weeks and we'll see. What has it meant for people to try and navigate this space over time?
So it's been dependent upon trust. And I think we've all learned very important lessons about trust over the past year, because we've all been making decisions in very uncertain times. But it's also been a lot about communication, because in a lot of communities across our country, transmission has been rampant. And so even seemingly low-risk activities, people can get infected. People can get infected in their pods. And so the problem with that is just this kind of uncomfortable feeling I think a lot of us have. But the important thing to remember is that we cannot stigmatize this disease. I mean, this illness is running through our communities. It is very transmissible. We know how to mitigate with appropriate precautions, and podding is part of that. It helps us to create that balance. But, you know, having the conversation with individuals in your pod about honest conversations about who you're interacting with, and also maybe needing to change the pod up a little bit and having an appropriate 2-week period where perhaps, you know, you're going to pod up with somebody new and you make sure that there's a washout of 2 weeks before you fully engage with that individual in a pod.
Let's talk about that washout though. Let's talk about that 2 week, because again, I think that at this point, when I've asked people, are you quarantining? They don't understand it to mean I'm staying at home for 2 full weeks without any contact with the outside world. They sort of understand it like, well, I'm not really seeing anybody, but I may be doing shopping and doing other things. And so even the concept of quarantining, I think, has become a lot more loosely defined at this point.
Right. And when we use the word quarantine, it is actually for individuals who have had known exposure to the virus, right? So quarantining is a very specific situation where individuals with known exposure to the virus have been asked to hunker down for 2 weeks or 10 days in their home. Individuals who have been vaccinated now will be exempt from that. But essentially, you're asked to sit in your house and wait. Wait to see if you become sick, because the problem is this virus can create a lot of asymptomatic infections, and it can also create a situation where you're infectious before you get symptoms. The rest of us, what we're doing without having known exposure to the virus, and if we are not ill with the virus, we are being as careful as we can and using our own risk calculations to determine what activities we feel comfortable with and what is not okay for us or our families. And so that is a difference. So that when I talk about a washout period, I'm talking about, you know, perhaps you were engaged with a pod, you're going to break from that pod and go to a different pod, having 2 weeks where you are doing minimal activities and you're not interacting with other people so that you can come into that new pod knowing that you're not bringing any infection with you.
There are some new things that are coming out in the market. We talked about vaccines a little bit. There's also rapid testing. What's your sense of people saying, you know what, I want to have a birthday party or a gathering. Everybody just take a rapid test today and let's all come in and hang out.
So I think the important thing to remember about rapid tests is they are amazing tools. And honestly, we need more of them. Because in a situation like that, if somebody does have a positive rapid test that morning, hopefully they would say, you know what, I'm not going to that birthday party. I'm not going to work. I don't have to tell anybody why. I'm just not going to do it, right? And so those can be important decision-making tools. But the other thing to remember about rapid tests is, you know, it's just for that moment. So you don't want to be doing rapid tests 3 days before the party. You want to be doing rapid tests the morning of the party. And you want to also remember that no test is perfect. And so there could be a false negative. There could be a false positive. And so, you know, overall, is it going to reduce your risk if you have that knowledge right before you attend a party? Sure, if people act appropriately on that knowledge and recognize it's still not a zero risk scenario.
If someone in a pod gets sick, what should people do?
So first of all, say, what can I do to help, right? Because your pod mates are the people that you're with through this. And that doesn't mean you go over to their house. That means maybe you send them flowers, you help get a grocery delivery for them, something like that. Because isolation is what happens when somebody gets sick, and it is hard. And if that person that you've been podding with lives alone, for example, they need a support system while they're alone. So be sure you reach out and you say, what can I do to help from a safe distance? And then, honestly, if you've had contact with them within a reasonable time frame, be sure you're answering your call, because a contact tracer may be calling you. But also, it's a good idea just to really kind of monitor your own health and don't go into situations where you might be in close contact with individuals who are at higher risk, right? So don't go see grandma after somebody in your pod just became ill, even if that was something that you had been planning for a while. Make sure that your decision-making, and keep that phone on, because if a contact tracer deems you a close contact within the reasonable time period, you will be asked to quarantine.
And what about people who don't have pods? What should they be thinking about 1 year in? I don't have a pod. So I'm trying to think about what do I think about now? But I also have a one-year-old, so.
Right. So pods are something where, you know, some people are engaged with them at different times than others, because everything we do right now is our own risk calculation. So having your own framework for making decisions right now is really important. We've put out a framework to help guide decision-making in this. So maybe that can be a part of your decision-making when you're thinking about having a pod or not having a pod. And if you don't have a pod, just remember that you need to keep your contacts still at a minimum when we're talking about close contacts. We are still in this pandemic. So following all the mitigation procedures when you're in the community, which includes proper and consistent mask wearing, social distancing, even in the grocery store, and hand washing, so important. And if you feel like you're ready to engage with a pod, you know, go through that process of making sure that you have selected somebody who has a similar risk tolerance than what you do, and you can come to some agreed upon terms about how your pod will function.
Carrie Althoff is an associate professor of epidemiology at Johns Hopkins University. Carrie, thanks so much for talking to us about pods.
Absolutely. Thanks for
each election season, political memoirs abound, doorstops that sometimes divulge more than intended.
No matter how diligently they present themselves in the most electable light, they always reveal themselves, their insecurities, their fears, their ambitions.
How to read a Politico on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Rush Limbaugh, whose bigoted and derogatory radio show became one of the highest-rated talk shows on the U.S. airwaves, died on Wednesday at the age of 70. Limbaugh regularly targeted Americans of color, including the nation's first black presidential couple, with racist diatribes. And he also attacked members of the LGBTQ community and was well known for making deeply sexist commentary toward women. Most recently, he downplayed the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic and pushed false claims that Democrats stole the 2020 election from Donald Trump. Limbaugh's politics laid the groundwork for decades of growing radicalism in the Republican Party and the emergence of President Donald Trump, and forever changed the influence of talk radio in politics. Matt Gertz is a senior fellow at Media Matters, and he joins me now to talk about Limbaugh's legacy. Welcome back to the show, Matt.
Good to be here.
What did Rush Limbaugh tap into in the late 1980s, early 90s, as his show was beginning to take off?
He tapped into a rich vein of white grievance and rage. This was a period of time in which the unraveling of the fairness doctrine had made it possible for someone like Rush Limbaugh to be broadcast nationally. He took advantage of that wholeheartedly, and he was phenomenally effective in building and cultivating and retaining a huge audience for decades. And he did it by feeding that audience a sort of toxic slurry of bigotry, of conspiracy theories, of unhinged vitriol. And they loved it. And it helped make the Republican Party what it is today.
And I'm wondering, as he did this, this obviously laid the groundwork, as you said, for the Republican Party today, particularly for President Trump's win, I would gather. I mean, this is something that I think was, for some Americans, was a piece of the radio world that they never heard. And for other Americans, they were totally tuned in to this, so much so that his show became the highest rated show. And so how do we connect what happened then to sort of this very outward, racially and racist, radicalized movement that it's become?
I think there's a very direct and straight line from Rush Limbaugh to Donald Trump. And the sort of uniting factor is the Republican Party. Republicans of all stripes, really, appreciated what Rush Limbaugh did for the party. He brought in he brought his audience into their tent. They catered to him. They sought his advice. They praised him. George H.W. Bush, who invited Limbaugh into the White House and campaigned with him, through Trump himself. You know, the party found ways to make excuses for his bigotry. They said, you know, he was just joking. They said that he had been taken out of context. Limbaugh became too big to fail within the Republican Party.
And was that because he was bringing in money?
It's because he was bringing in supporters. Mm-hmm. The 1994 Republican House majority, they named him an honorary member of that class of 1994, which you'll recall was the first time Republicans had held the House in decades. He gave them air cover, that he convinced his audience that the media could not be trusted and only he could be trusted. And because of that, they believed him instead of the press at large. And he brought them into the Republican Party ranks.
And we've gone really from, you know, the 1980s culture wars, if you will, to what I'm calling this moment of information wars. And, you know, Rush Limbaugh was somebody who did say lots of things that were lies and conspiracy theories. And yet that seems to be where we are today with even more misinformation. Was he one of the people who you think laid the groundwork for the conspiracy theories and the openness to those conspiracy theories that we see today in the political circle?
Absolutely. I mean, if you go back to the 1990s, he was suggesting that Vince Foster, the Clinton White House aide who committed suicide in the early 90s, had actually been murdered by the Clintons. That sort of conspiracy theory is a through line of his career, going up to the last few years where he was describing various right-wing terror attacks as false flags and claiming that the coronavirus was a hoax perpetrated by the media against Donald Trump. That sort of conspiratorial thinking is very much a part of Rush Limbaugh's show. And it, of course, paved the way for the Republican Party at large to adopt that sort of thinking.
Matt, we often talk a lot about, folks often talk a lot about Fox News being the sort of juggernaut that got Trump in office and others, but we cannot ignore the influence and power that not just Rush Limbaugh had, but also talk radio had on what I'm suggesting is really radicalizing folks to think and believe a lot of these conspiracy theories. Where does conservative media or radical conservative media stand today, now that Rush Limbaugh is no longer with us?
Well, it's really becoming an increasingly fractured and competitive place. For the last 30 years or so, it's been dominated, as you say, by Rush Limbaugh, by Fox News, headed by Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch. They really laid the groundwork for the modern right-wing media, but as they pass from the scene, you're seeing Fox News come under attack from new rivals for not being right-wing enough, not being pro-Trump enough, and that is forcing them to move further to the right to compete for viewers. You see the increasingly fractured social media landscape, the landscape of more extreme conservative streamers on YouTube and other channels who have broken off and are creating audiences and brands unique to themselves rather to a larger network, the same way Limbaugh did 30 years before.
We're going to see where and how this all plays out. Matt Gertz is a senior fellow at Media Matters. Matt, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, folks, that's it for us today. Amy Walter is in tomorrow, and I'll be back on Monday. But before I go, I wanted to share a voice memo we got from a listener yesterday about our segment on Salsa King Johnny Pacheco. Take a listen.
Tanzina, my name is Melanie Martinez, and I'm standing in my kitchen in Los Angeles moved to tears by your beautiful story on Johnny Pacheco and your two guests, including Bobby Sanabria. I grew up in the suburbs of New York City. My mom grew up in Spanish Harlem. My dad grew up in the South Bronx. They met at a dance hall doing salsa, dancing together. That is the music that created me and my family and all the memories of my family. And the fact that you've included this story means so much. And here at home, we are still dancing.
Keep those voice memos coming. Remember, you can record it on your phone and send them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. A quick shout out to the Takeaway team that makes this show every week. Sham Sundra was our board op this week. Vince Fairchild is our broadcast engineer. Jake Howitt is our director and sound designer. Our senior producers are Alexandra Boutte and Amber Hall. And our producers are Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Lydia McMullen Laird, and Patricia Jacob. Our line producers are Jackie Martin and Jose Olivares. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.